Poole nodding wearily to the black man's long explanation of something. It was the most foreign babbling I had ever heard, with not a single word that I recognised. Thick insisted on reporting how he had spent his time with the black man, with many descriptions of food, of Chade being angry and upset, and of a wonderful sliding place he had discovered not far away. I looked at his round face, beaming with contentment. He was a wonderful man. He accepted with equanimity that I had returned, that the fool was no longer dead, and that soon we would be back home without going on a boat. His joy at sliding on snow was equal to his joy at my return. I envied his easy acquiescence to change and the future. As we prattled, I tried to decipher what the future held for me. We would go back to Buckkeep and I'd have the task of transporting the skill library there. Already I dreaded how many trips through the pillars that would entail. Yet that task became simple when I thought of what would follow. I had to introduce myself to Nettle, and reveal to Molly that I lived. Such a wave of longing swept through me at that thought that it near took my breath away. In restoring the full range of my memories of her, the fool had swept my heart back in time to that moment when I first knew I had lost her. The anguish was fresh, and my love for her as strong. I dreaded the thought of our first meeting, and all the explaining I must do. I dreaded facing her grief for her husband, but I knew I must. Burrick had cared for my daughter when I had died. Could I do less for his little sons? And yet it was not going to be easy. None of it was going to be easy. Yet with an odd sideways tilt of my heart, I realized I was anticipating it, that I believed that beyond the sorrow we would share at Burrick's death, there might eventually be something else. I felt shallow and greedy, even as I thought of it, but nonetheless it was there. It seemed years since I had looked ahead and seen opportunities and possibilities. I suddenly knew that I wanted change and life, and the dangers of attempting to win Molly's love again. Thick shook me by the shoulder.
"So?"
he asked me delightedly.
"So you want to go now?"
"Yes," I found myself saying, and then discovered that I had been smiling and nodding so to his descriptions of sliding on the snow. I'd volunteered to go sliding with him. His delight was too great for me to crush it, and it suddenly came to me that I truly had nothing better to do at the moment. The fool could do with rest, and he seemed to be enjoying his talk with the black man. So we bundled up and went outside again. I had planned to slide with him once or twice, just enough to content him, but the slope he had found was as long and sweeping as an otter slide, and just as inviting. Thick's use of it over the last few days had polished it smooth. We slid on our bellies, and then together, on top of my cloak, whooping like children, heedless of how wet and cold we got. It was play, pure and simple, play that I'd had no time for, that I had dismissed as unnecessary, and an interruption to all the practical tasks of a well-ordered life. When had I lost sight of taking simple pleasure for the sake of pleasure? I forgot myself in it, and came back to the world with a start when I heard my name being called. I had just come to the end of the slide, and as I turned to the fool's voice, Thick crashed into me from behind. I went flying and landed, mostly unhurt, with Thick on top of me. We floundered to our feet to find the fool watching us with amusement and fondness that was hard to look upon. Regret and wistfulness were there also. "You should try it," I told him, half embarrassed, to be caught cavorting like a boy in the first snow of the year. I stood and helped Thick to his feet. He was grinning despite his tumble. "My back," the fool said quietly, and I nodded, feeling suddenly subdued. I knew it was more than his newly healed back, more than the stiffness of half-healed hurts. His experience had scarred and stiffened more than his body. I wondered how long it would be before his spirit regained its flexibility. "You'll heal," I assured us both as I walked up to him. I wished I'd been more certain. "Prilcop has made food for us," he told me. "I've come to tell you it's ready. We shouted from the door, but you didn't hear us." He paused. The walk down looked easy. It wasn't. Now I dread the walk up again. "It's steep," I agreed as we started back. At the mention of food, Thick had broken into a trot and preceded us. "Prilcop?" "The black man's name." The fool trudged along beside me as we headed back to the steep cliffside trail. He was breathless. It took him a moment or two to recall it. It has been long since he had anyone to speak with, and longer still since he has spoken our native tongue. You both seem to be enjoying it, I said, and hoped I did not sound jealous. Yes, he agreed. He almost smiled. It has been so long since he was home that when I told him my childhood memories, he could only marvel at how many things had changed. We both wonder what things are like there now. Well, I suppose he could go home now if he wished. I mean, he has no vision to keep him here any more, does he? No. We walked a bit in silence, and then the fool said quietly, Fitz, home is people, not a place. If you go back there after the people are gone, then all you can see is what is not there any more. He set his hand on my arm, and I halted. Let me breathe, he begged, and then defeated our pause by speaking. You are the only one who should go home, he told me earnestly, while you still can, while there are people there who will know you and rejoice in your return, not just Buckkeep. Molly, and Patience. I know. I intend to. I looked at him, puzzled, surprised that he had thought I would not. His face went almost blank with astonishment. You will? You are? Of course. You mean it, don't you? His eyes searched my face. Almost I saw a shadow of disappointment there. But then he seized one of my hands in both of his and said, I am glad for you, Fitz. Truly glad. You had said you would, but you seemed hesitant. I thought perhaps you would change your mind. What else would I do? He hesitated a moment, as if he would say something. Then he seemed to change his mind. He gave a small snort. Huh. Go find a cave to live in alone for the next decade or so? Why would I do that? Retreat from life, and there is no opportunity for anything to get better. Oh. And then I was rewarded by the slow spread of his old smile across his face. Help me up the path, he said, and I was glad to do so. He leaned more heavily on my arm than I had expected him to. When we reached Prilcop's cavern, I made him sit down. Spirits? Brandy? I asked of Prilcop, and when the fool had weakly translated my words, the black man shook his head. He came closer to the fool and bent down to look into his face. He touched the fool's forehead and then shook his head.
I will make a tea. For this, a helpful tea.
We ate together and passed the evening telling stories. The fool and Prilcop seemed to have slaked some of their thirst for conversing in their own tongue. I made up a pallet for the fool and insisted he lie down near the fire. I tried to tell Prilcop the full tale of how we had come to Aslevial. He listened intently, nodding, his brow furrowed. From time to time the fool would offer a brief explanation to Prilcop of some part of our tale that he did not understand. Mostly he lay still, eyes closed, listening. When he did break into my telling, it was strange to hear how the fool pieced out our life tale for him, for he made it seem as if always the goal had been to awaken and restore true dragons to the world. I suppose that for him it had been, but it was peculiar to see my own life in that light. It became very late, and Thick had dozed off long ago before Prilcop bade us good night. I knew an odd moment of awkwardness when I spread my blankets separately from the fool's. There was plenty of bedding here, no need to share any more. But I had slept beside him for so many nights that I wondered if he would want the comfort of me close by to guard him from his night terrors, but I could not find a way to ask him. Instead, I propped my head on my arm and watched him sleep. His face was slack with exhaustion, yet pain still furrowed his brow. I knew that after all he had been through, he would need time apart from me, time alone with himself to discover once again who he was. Yet selfishly I did not want him to grow apart from me again. Not only my love for Molly, but my boyish fondness and closeness to the fool had been rejuvenated as well. To be the best of friends again, making nothing of one another's differences, to enjoy the days and face hardships optimistically. He represented all that to me, and I vowed I would not let that carelessly slip from my grip again. He and Molly would round out my life to what it should have been. And Patience, I thought with wonder. I would reclaim her, too, and never heed the cost. Perhaps it was that Thick slept close by me, or perhaps it was that, for the first time since I'd ventured into the Pale Woman's realm, I slept deeply enough to dream my own dreams. In either case, Nettle found me. Or perhaps I found her. I found myself in an evening place. It was a place I almost remembered, yet it had changed so much that I was not certain of it. Banks of flowers glowed luminously in the dimness. Somewhere a fountain played, a muted splashing. The evening fragrances of blossoms wafted and blended on the night breeze. Nettle was sitting on a stone bench, alone. She leaned her head against the wall behind her and stared up at the night sky. I winced when I saw her. Her beautiful hair had been shorn down to her scalp. It was the oldest sign of mourning in the Six Duchies, and not often practiced among women. I came and sat on the paving stones in front of her in my wolf guise. She stirred and looked down at me.
"You know that my father is dead?"
"Yes, I am sorry." Her fingers toyed with a fold of her dark skirt.
"Were you there?"
she asked at last. "When he died, no. When he took the injury that would kill him, yes." A little silence spun out between us.
"Why do I feel so awkward asking this? As if it is improper for me to be curious. I know that the prince thinks it more appropriate to speak all around it and say only that my father was a hero and fought well. But that is not enough for me. I want to know how he died, was hurt. I need to know every detail. Because they dumped his body in the sea and I will never see him again, dead or alive. Do you know how that feels? Just to be told that your father is dead and that is all."
"I know exactly how it feels," I said. "So it was done to me, also."
"But eventually they told you?"
"They told me the lie that they told everyone. No, I was never told how he truly died."
"I am sorry,"
she said, and meant it. She turned her head and looked at me curiously.
"You've changed, Shadow Wolf. You ring. You are like a bell when it is struck. What is the word?"
"Resonate," I suggested, and she nodded.
"I feel you more clearly, almost as if you were real."
"I am real.
I mean, real here."
"I wish that I were." "How much of it do you want to know?" I asked her. She lifted her chin.
"Oh, everything. He was my father."
"That he was," I was forced to agree. I steeled myself. It was time. Then another thought came to me, and I asked her, "Where are you now, when you are awake?" She sighed.
"As you see, in the Queen's garden at Buckkeep Castle," she said forlornly. "The Queen allowed me to go home for 3 days. She apologized to me and to my mother, but said it was as much time as she could spare me now for my mourning. Ever since I learned to dream true, not even my nights have belonged to me. Always I am at the call of the Farseer throne, expected to give my entire life to it."
I phrased it carefully. "In that, you are your father's child." She blazed up at me suddenly, lighting the garden with her wrath.
"He gave his life for them. And what did he get in return? Nothing. Well, some estate, now that he is dead, some Withywoods place I've never heard of. What do I care for land and a title? Lady Nettle, they call me now, as if I were a noble's daughter, and Lady Thornbush, they call me, behind my back, simply because I speak my mind in honest words. I care nothing for what they think of me. As soon as I can, I will leave this court and go home, to my real home. The house my father built, and his barns and pastures, they can take Withywoods and tear it stone from stone for all I care. I'd rather have my father."
"So would I. But all the same, you have more right to Withywoods than anyone else. Your father served Prince Chivalry, and that estate was one of his favourites. It is almost as if you are Chivalry's heir that you receive it." And I was sure that was what Patience had intended. She could count the months and years on her fingers and know that Molly's child was mine. The old woman had done her best to see something of her grandfather's lands passed on to Nettle. It warmed my heart that she had done so. I suddenly knew why Patience had waited until after Burick's death to see the land go to Nettle. It was because she had respected his claim to Nettle's paternity, and would do nothing to make anyone else question it. Now the lands would appear a thing that Burick had earned for his family, rather than an inheritance passed on to a grandchild. The subtleties of my eccentric stepmother would always delight me.
"I would still rather have my father,"
she sniffed, and turned her face from me. She spoke to the darkness, hoarsely.
"Are you going to tell me what happened to him?"
"Yes, I am. but I am trying to decide where to begin that tale. I weighed the caution against courage and then suddenly realized my decision should not rest on my feelings at all. How much should a young woman, alone and in grief, suddenly be confronted with? Now was not the time to change her perception of who she was. She was facing enough changes. Let her grieve, unfettered by questions such as my revelations could raise for her. Your father took his death wound in service to the Farseer monarchy, it is true. But when by sheer will alone he dropped a dragon to his knees, it was not for his prince. It was because the stone dragon had threatened his beloved son. She was incredulous.
Swift?
Of course. Swift was why he came here. To get his son and take him safely home, he did not think there would be a real dragon to face.
There is so much I don't understand. You call the dragon that they face the stone dragon. What is that?
She deserved to know. And so I told her a hero's tale full of the pale woman's dark magic and of a man who had come half-blind and alone to face down a dragon for the sake of his wayward son. I told her, too, of how Swift had stood before the dragon's charge and sped the arrow that slew him. And then I spoke of Swift's loyalty to her father as he lay dying. I even explained the earring that Swift would be wearing when he returned home to them. She wept as I spoke, black tears that vanished as they fell. Her garden faded around us and the icy glacier wind blew past us, and I realized the strength of my telling was such that she saw it, much as I had. Only when my words had faded did the garden ease back into existence around us. The fragrances were sharper, as if a recent rain had watered them. A moth fluttered by.
"But when will Swift come home?" she demanded anxiously. "It is hard enough for my mother to know her husband is dead. She should not have to worry whether her son will return safely. Why do they linger so long there when their task is done?"
"Swift serves his prince. He will come back when Dutiful returns," I assured her. "They are still negotiating the marriage that will bind our countries in friendship. These things take time."
"What is wrong with that girl?" Nettle demanded angrily. "Is she without a mind, or has she no honour? She should live up to the word she gave. She got a dragon's head on the hearthstones. I saw to that."
"So I have heard," I told her wryly.
"I was so angry with him," she told me confidentially. "It was the only thing I could think of to do."
"You were angry with Icefire?"
"No! With Prince Dutiful. Dither, dither, dither. Does she like me? Does she love me? I won't force her to keep a bargain made under duress. I am so, so very noble. Why does not he tell that fickle out-islander girl, 'I paid the toll and I'll cross the bridge'? I'm sure I would have."
Then her blaze of indignation suddenly damped as she said,
"You don't think I'm traitorous to speak so of him, do you? I mean no disrespect. I am as loyal a subject to our illustrious prince as anyone. It's just that when you speak with someone mind to mind, it is hard to remember that he is a prince and far above me. There are times when he seems as thick-witted as one of my brothers, and I just want to shake him."
Despite her earlier protestation of loyalty to her monarch, she suddenly sounded like a girl very exasperated with foolish boys. "So what did you do?"
"Well, at that time, those out-islander people were making much fuss over him not having put the dragon's head on the hearthstone of her mother's house. As if rescuing her mother and sister were not worth the weight of a bloody dead animal head stinking in front of your fireplace."
I could feel the effort it took her to restrain herself.
"Mind you, I only know of these things as I relay them to the Queen. I am the one who must stand before her each morning and pass on such tidings as they send through me. Does he think that is pleasant? But it occurred to me one dawn, after leaving my queen solemn and heavy of heart because the marriage might not happen at all, that perhaps there was something I could do. Despite her bluster and threats, I know Tintaglia well. Perhaps because of those things I know her well. So as she had pestered me, disturbing my dreams whenever I slept, so I began to do to her. For in all her comings and goings from my sleep, she had worn a sort of path that I could follow back to her. If that makes sense to you."
"It does. But I still marvel that anyone would dare pester such a creature."
"Oh, in the dream world, we are well matched. As I think you might remember, I doubt she would fly all the way here just to trample a mere human. And unlike me, she prefers to sleep heavily after she has eaten or mated. So,
Those were precisely the times I chose to bother her.
And you asked her to ask Icefire to return to Male Isle and put his head down on the Narcheska's hearth?
Asked her? No, I demanded it. And when she said she would not, I said it was because she could not, that despite all humans had done to rescue him, Icefire was too petty to acknowledge the debt, and that she durst not make him do it, for though she claims to be a queen, she allowed him to master and drive her. I said that her mating must have addled her brains. That put her in a froth, I can tell you. But how did you know it would?
I didn't. I just got angry and said what first came to me.
I felt her sigh.
It's a fault I have, one that has not made me popular in this court. I am too swift of tongue. But I think it is the best way to speak to a dragon. I told her that if she could not make Icefire do what was right, then she needn't flaunt about so high and mighty. I hate it when people lord over you when you know that given a good scratch they're no better than you are.
She paused, then added,
Or dragons. In all the legends, they are wise, or incredibly powerful, or...
They are incredibly powerful, I interrupted her. I assure you of that.
Perhaps. But Tintaglia, in some ways she's like... me. Sting her pride a bit, and she has to prove she can do whatever you've told her she can't. She's a nag, or worse, a bully when she thinks she can get away with it. And just because she lived so long and was born remembering so much, she acts as if we are moths or ants with no lives worth honouring.
It sounds as if you've had more than one conversation with her in this regard. She paused a trifle.
Tintaglia is an interesting creature. I don't think I'd ever dare call her my friend. She thinks she is. Or more accurately, I think she believes I owe her loyalty and duty or worship simply because she is a dragon. But it is hard to call someone your friend when you know that your death would mean no more to her than a moth flying into a candle means to me. Oh, it's gone. Too bad. As if I were just an animal.
She snatched a flower from a nearby bed, as if to tear it apart. I winced. She sensed it.
No, I meant like an insect or a fish, not like a wolf.
Then, as if the thought had only just come to her,
You aren't as I see you in my mind. I know that now. I know you aren't a wolf. I mean, I don't think of you as just an animal. Did I hurt your feelings?
Hastily she restored the flower to its broken stem. She had, but I didn't think I could explain it to myself, let alone her.
It's fine. I know what you meant.
And when you come back with the others, I'll finally get to meet you and see you as you are.
When I come back, it's very likely we'll meet.
But how will I know you?
I'll tell you it's me.
Good.
Hesitantly she added,
I missed you while you were gone. I wanted to talk to you when they told me my father was dead, but I couldn't find you. Where did you go?
Someone very important to me was in trouble. I went to help him, but now that's all settled, and we'll be coming home soon.
Someone important to you? Will I meet him?
Of course. I think you'll like him.
Who are you?
I wasn't expecting the question just then. It took me off balance. I didn't want to tell her that I was Fitzchivalry or Tom Badgerlock. I found myself saying, unplanned, I'm someone who used to know your mother, before she met Burrick and married him. Her reaction was not what I expected.
You're that old?
She was shocked. And I think I just got older, I told her, laughing. But she did not laugh with me. Her reply was stiff.
Then I suppose that when you return you are more like to be my mother's friend than mine.
There was a complication I had not counted on. Jealousy rang green in her thoughts. I tried to stem it. Nettle, I have long cared about both of you, and will continue to do so. Even colder, she asked.
Will you try to take my father's place with her?
I felt a blundering fool. I groped for an answer, and then forced myself to face a truth I'd been avoiding. Nettle, they were together for, what, 16 years? They shared 7 children. Do you think anyone could take his place with her?
Just so you understand that, she replied, somewhat mollified, and then she dismissed me with, Now I must clear my dreams of you in case the prince wishes to find me. Almost every night he or Lord Chade has words I must bear to the queen. I get little time to make my own dreams any more. Good night, Shadow Wolf.
and then her fragrant garden and gentle twilight world faded away from me, and I was left in the darkness. It took a short time for me to realize I was not asleep at all, but was lying on the floor of the black man's cave, staring into shadows dimly lit by the embers in his fireplace. I thought over what I had told Nettle and decided that I had been foolish to let her know that I had once loved Molly. And how could I not have foreseen that Molly's children, including Nettle, might see me as an interloper in their household? I felt discouragement wash over me, and considered a total retreat from all of it. But in the wake of that, I found iron resolution. No, I would not flee from the chaos I had made of my life. I loved Molly still, and I thought it possible that she might still have some feelings for me. Even if she didn't, I had told Barrick that I would see to the well-being of his younger children. I would be needed there, even if I were not welcomed at first. I might fail. Molly might even drive me off, but I would not surrender before I had tried. I was going home.
Chapter 32. Through Stones. The witness stones have stood time out of mind, through storm and earthquake, on Witness Hill, near Buckkeep Castle. There is no record of who raised them. Some say that they are as old as the foundations of Buckkeep Castle itself. Others say they are older still. A number of traditions have grown up around them. It is a popular place for couples to pledge their wedding vows, for it is said that if someone speaks falsely before the stones, the gods themselves will punish them. It is also said that if men meet there to decide the truth by contest, the stones will look down and see that the victory goes to the honourable man. There are similar standing stones throughout the six duchies and beyond. All seem to be carved of the same black stone. All seem to have been sturdily set to withstand all elements. Some are decorated with runes. Others seem to be plain, but a closer inspection usually reveals that runes once graced them, and have either worn away or been chiselled off them. Although we have not been able to find mention of them in the skill scrolls we have, they were almost certainly used by the Elderlings as a method for swift transit from one place to another. Herewith I have set out a map of the known skill pillars, as I shall call them. On this map I have clearly marked a legend that shows which runes apply to which locations. Although some of the skill pillars shown may appear to be unmarked, an experienced skill user can still use them for transit. It is not suggested that younger users of the skill be allowed to travel through the stones alone. Indeed, they should always be accompanied by an experienced user, and should only use the stones for travel as an absolute necessity. It can be a taxing experience for the novice user, leading to exhaustion or, in the case of forced overuse, madness. Chade Falstars, On Skill Pillars. The fool's fragile recovery collapsed in the early hours. I awoke in darkness to the sounds of him tossing and struggling in his sleep. When I tried to wake him, his face was warm, and I could not break him from his nightmares. I sat beside him, holding his hand and talking to him softly, easing him into quieter dreams. I was uncomfortably aware that the black man had awakened. He lay on his bed and silently watched me with the fool. I could not see his eyes, but I felt them on me. He measured us, and I did not know why. Towards dawn I felt Chade's press against my mind. Reluctantly I admitted him. "You can go home now. This will be your tale. The prince and I sent you home early with Thick on a trading vessel, as Thick was miserable here, and we wished you to bear tidings to the queen immediately. I think that will be believable. Just avoid giving any details. I shall be so glad to have you in place there. Nettle is a fine girl, but we have had to be very circumspect in our reports through her, and very careful not to task her beyond her abilities. It is imperative I have someone in place who can be privy to the sort of information that must be conveyed to the queen. I cannot go now, Chade. The fool has fallen ill. He cannot travel." Chade was silent for a few moments, then, "But from what you said, you would not have to carry him far, just to the skill pillar, and then whisk him home, to healers, and warmth, and safety." "I wish it were that simple. The path to the pillar is very treacherous and cold, and the journey through the skill pillar is tasking for him. I dare not risk him. He has already been through too much." "I see." I felt Chade weighing my words. Then, "Do you think he will be better a day from now? I could give you another day." I made my thoughts firm. "I do not know, but I will take as many days as he needs, Chade. I will not risk him."
Very well. The thought oozed annoyance, but also acceptance. If you must. Indeed, I must, I replied firmly. We will travel when the fool is stronger, not before. Dawn found me hollow with worry. Well I knew that many men who died from battle wounds died days after the battle, from fevers and flux and infection. The journey here had strained his healing and undone many days of rest. The fool slept heavily, far past midday, and then woke, gummy-eyed and haggard, to drink cup after cup of water. Prilkop insisted that we move him from the floor to his bed. The fool made the short, staggering walk between us, then folded onto the black man's bed as if he were exhausted, and almost immediately sank down into sleep. His skin was warm beneath my touch. "Perhaps it's just one of his changing times," I told Prilkop. "So I hope. It would be better than infection. He will be feverish and weak for several days, and then shed a layer of skin, as if he'd been burned. Underneath, his new skin will be darker. If that is what this is, there's little we can do for him now except keep him comfortable and wait." Prilkop touched both his cheeks with a gesture, and then smiled at me, saying,
"This I suspected. To some of us it happens. The discomfort passes."
Then, looking down at the fool, he added,
"If that is all of it..."
He shook his head. "The injuries to him were many." A question came to me, and I asked it without pausing to wonder if it were impolite. "Why did you change? Why is the fool changing? The pale woman remained white." He lifted his hands, expressing bafflement.
"On this, I have thought many times. Perhaps, as we cause change, we change. Other prophets who remain white often speak much, but do little. He and I, in our youths, much change we foretold. Then, out we went, and made changes. And perhaps we also changed ourselves."
"But the pale woman also did things to try to make changes." He smiled, grimly satisfied.
"She tried. She failed. We prevailed. We changed."
Then he tilted his head to one side.
"Perhaps so this old man thinks."
Prilkop glanced over at the sleeping fool and nodded to himself.
"Rest is what he needs. Sleep, and good food, and quiet. You and Thick, go fishing. Fresh fish would be good for him."
I shook my head. "I don't want to leave him when he's like this." Prilkop put a gentle hand on my shoulder.
"You make him restless. He feels your worry. To let him rest, you away go."
Thick spoke up from his corner by the hearth.
"We should go home. I want to go home."
The fool startled me when he croaked my name.
"Fitz."
I was instantly at his side with water. He did not want to drink it, but I was insistent. When he turned his face from the cup, I took it away. Was there something else you wanted? His eyes were unnaturally bright with fever.
"Yes, I want you to go home."
"He doesn't know what he's saying," I told Prilkop. "I couldn't take him like this." The fool drew a deep breath. He spoke with an effort.
"Yes, I do know what I'm saying. Take Thick. Go home. Leave me here."
He coughed and then motioned for more water. He drank it in sips and then pulled in another deep breath. I let him lie back in his blankets.
"I won't leave you like this," I promised him. "I'll take as much time as we need here. Don't worry about anything. I'll be right here." "No."
He seemed irritable, in that weary way the sick do.
"Listen to me. I need to stay here for a time with Prilkop. I need to understand when I am, where I am. I need to. Fitz, he can help me. You know I will not die of this. It is only my changing time. But what I need to learn, I must learn alone. Be alone for a time. I need to think alone. You understand. I know you do. I was you.
He lifted thinning fingers to rub at his face and cheeks. The dry skin rippled and rolled under his fingers, flaking away from newer, darker skin beneath. He rolled his eyes to Prilkop.
He should go,
he said, as if Prilkop could force me.
He is needed at home, and he needs to be home.
I sat down on the floor by the bed. I did understand. I remembered the long days of my recovery, after my time in Regal's dungeon. I recalled the uncertainty I had felt. Torture shames a man. To break and scream, to beg, to make promises. Unless a man has endured that, perhaps he cannot forgive it in another. The fool needed time alone to reassess how he saw himself. I had not wanted Burrick to ask 1,000 questions of me. I had not even wanted him to be solicitous and kind. On some instinctive level, he had known that, and had allowed me my days of sitting and staring, unspeaking, over the meadows and hills. It had been difficult to admit I was a human and not a wolf. It had been harder to admit I was still myself. The fool extended a thin hand from under his blankets. He patted my shoulder awkwardly, and then ran his fingers down my bearded cheek.
"Go home, and shave while you're there,"
he managed a faint smile, then,
"Let me rest, Fitz. Just let me rest."
"Very well." I tried not to feel that he dismissed me. I turned to Thick. "I'll take you home, then. Dress warmly, but you needn't pack anything. Before the night is over, we'll be in Buckkeep."
"And warm again,"
Thick pressed me.
"And with good things to eat. Fresh bread and butter, milk and apples, sweet cakes and raisins, cheese and bacon. Tonight."
"I'll do my best. You get ready and tell Chade for me that we're going home tonight. I'll tell the guard at the gate that we came home early, on the first boat, because you were cold."
"I am cold,"
he agreed heartily.
"But no boats, you promised."
I hadn't, but I nodded anyway. "No boats. Get ready, Thick." I turned back to the fool. He had closed his eyes again. I spoke softly. "So, you get your way. As you always seem to. I'll take Thick home. I will be gone for a day, at most 2 days, but then I'll come back and I'll bring back food and wine with me. What would you like? What could you eat?"
"Have you any apricots?"
the fool asked me in a wavering voice. Plainly he had not grasped the whole of what I had told him. "I'll try to bring you some," I said, doubting I could, but loath to tell him so. I smoothed his hair back from his warm face. His hair felt stiff and dry. I looked at Prilkop. He nodded slowly to my silent plea. Before I left, I tucked the blankets up over his shoulders. Then I stooped, and despite his closed eyes, I pressed my brow to his. "I'm coming back soon," I vowed. He made no response and perhaps already slept. I left him there. Prilkop, too, made his farewells to us within the cave. "Take care of him," I told the black man. "I'll be back tomorrow. Make sure he eats." He shook his head to my words.
"Not that soon," he cautioned me. "Already you have used the portals too many times. Too close together."
He made a motion as if he dragged something out of his chest.
"It takes from you. And if you do not have enough left for yourself, it can keep you."
He peered into my eyes, as if trying to be sure I had understood him. I hadn't, but I nodded and assured him, "I'll be careful."
"Farewell, thick man. Farewell, fool's changer."
Then, with the tip of his head toward the fool, he added quietly,
"I will watch over him. More than that, none of us can do."
And then, as if embarrassed to ask, he said,
"The small man said, cheese?"
"Cheese. Yes, I will bring you cheese, and tea, and spices, and fruit, as much as I can carry."
"When it is safe for you to come again, that would be nice."
He was beaming as we thanked him again for all he had done for us and then left. The wind had come up and the night was chill. Thick had stubbornly refused to abandon his pack, clinging to every single possession in it. So he came laden behind me as we edged up the steep and narrow path to the crack in the rock face. The trickle of moisture had iced it narrow again, and again I had to draw my sword and clash ice away in the darkness. Thick whimpered at the dark and the wind and kept insisting that he wanted to go home, not seeming to connect that I must first open the way so we could. I was finally able to squeeze through. I pulled Thick after me, though he wedged there for a moment. He followed me in, going slower and slower the closer we came to the unnatural light.
"I don't like this,"
he warned me.
"I don't think this is the way home. This is going in a rock. We should go back."
"No, Thick, it's all right. It's just an old magic. We'll be fine. Just follow me."
"You had better be right,"
he warned me. He followed me, looking all around himself at every step. The deeper we went, the more cautious he became. When we reached the first elderling carvings, he gasped and stepped back.
"The dragon dreams! Those were in the dragon dreams!"
he exclaimed. Then abruptly, as if I had been tricking him,
"Oh, I have been here before. Now I know. But why is it so cold? It didn't used to be so cold."
"Because we are under ice. That makes it cold. Come on now, stop walking so slowly."
"Not this cold,"
he replied cryptically, and followed me again, but no faster than he had before. I thought I had fixed the path in my mind. Despite that, I turned wrong twice. Each time I had to retrace my steps, Thick became more doubtful of me. But eventually, despite his laggard steps and my faulty memory, we reached the map room. "Don't touch anything," I warned him. I studied the map and the rune by the four tiny gems near Buckkeep. Those gems, I was convinced, represented the Witness Stones. For generations they had been regarded as a place of power and truth, a gateway to the gods. Now I suspected I knew the origin of that legend. I fixed the rune carefully in my mind. "Come, Thick," I told him. "It's time to go home." He made no reply, and even when I touched his shoulder, he looked up at me slowly. He had sunk down to sit on the floor. With one hand he had rubbed the dusty tiles clean to reveal a piece of a pastoral scene. His face had an almost dazed expression.
"They liked it here,"
he said softly.
"They played a lot of music."
"Put up your walls, Thick," I bade him, but did not feel that he obeyed me. I took his hand and held it firmly in mine. I wasn't sure he was listening, but as I led him up the stairs to the pillar room, I explained to him several times that we would hold tight to each other and walk through the pillar and be home. His breathing had become deep, and even as if he slept heavily. Uneasily, I wondered if the city itself were affecting him. I did not give myself time to wonder if the ancient and worn witness stones would still function as skill pillars. The fool had used one, hadn't he? And his skill was much less than mine. I drew a deep breath, gave Thick's hand a small shake in an attempt to win his attention, and then stepped determinedly into the pillar, drawing him behind me. Again there was that breathlessly long pause in my being, almost familiar now. There seemed to pass a star-speckled blackness of indeterminate length, and then I stepped out onto the grassy sward of the hillside near Buckkeep. Thick was still with me. I felt a moment's giddiness, and Thick stumbled past me and sat down flat on the turf. The warmth of summer touched our skins, and the smells of a summer night filled my nostrils. I stood still, letting my eyes adjust. The four witness stones loomed behind me, pointing at the night sky. I drew a deep breath of the warm air. I smelled sheep pastured nearby, and the more distant smell of the sea. We were home. I went to Thick and put a hand on his shoulder. "You're all right," I told him. "We're home, I told you, just like stepping through a door." Then a wave of dizziness swept through me, and I pitched forward onto my face. For a little time I lay there, trying not to retch.
"We are all right?"
Thick asked me miserably. "In a moment or two," I assured him breathlessly. "In a moment or two we'll be fine."
"That was as bad as the boat,"
he said accusingly. "But much shorter," I told him. "Much shorter a time." Despite my reassurances, it was some while before we recovered and got to our feet. It was a goodly hike from the witness stones to the gates of Buckkeep Castle, and Thick was puffing and complaining long before we got there. The frozen elderling city and the trip through the pillars seemed to have disoriented him and wearied him. I felt cruel as I hurried him along, tempting him with promises of wonderful food, cold ale, and a warm, soft bed. The rising sun lent light to us to avoid most tumbles. Before he had gone far, I was carrying Thick's pack, and then his cloak and hat. He would have shed more clothing if I had let him. By the time we reached the gates, we were sweating in our winter clothes on a fair morning. I think the guards recognized Thick before they did me. I was unshaven and unkempt. I told them that we'd been sent home early on a filthy out-islander coastal trader, and that it had been a miserable trip and we were glad to be home. Thick was only too glad to enlarge on my poor opinion of boats. The guards at the gates were full of questions, but I told them that we'd been sent home some time ago, and that it had taken us far too long to get here, and that I'd been ordered to report to the Queen before I shared any gossip. They let us through. It was mostly serving folk and guards up and about at that hour. I got Thick no further than the kitchens. The men in the guardroom had learned to tolerate the prince's pet. They would jest with him roughly and listen to his tales and measure them by their own. Any brag he made of dragons or magic pillars or black men would be taken with a large grain of salt there. I knew I had to leave him, and it was perhaps the safest place in the keep for him. Besides, I suspected that his mouth would be too full for much talk. I left him there with a hot meal and the admonition that as soon as he was finished eating, he should either go to bed in his room or seek out Sada, bathe, and let her know emphatically that no one on our voyage had died of seasickness. I took a roll of fresh bread with me and devoured it on my way to the barracks. The warm summer air seemed laden with scent after my long weeks in the cold. Our guard section of the long low barrack house was dusty and deserted. I rid myself of my heavy woolen clothes. I longed to stop to wash and shave, but instead simply pulled on a fresh guard's uniform. I longed even more to fall face down on my bed there, but I knew that I needed to see the Queen as soon as possible. I knew, too, that she would not be expecting me yet. I found my way to the hall that led to the larders and storage rooms for the kitchen. When no one else was in sight, I entered the storage room that had the cupboard with the false back in it. It was also where the hams and smoked sausages were stored, and I helped myself to a sausage before I closed the false door behind me and began my weary ascent of the dark stairs. I went by touch, feeling my way, for the steps were pitch black. I had finished my sausage by the time I reached the entry to Chade's tower room. I opened the door and stepped in. Darkness and a musty smell greeted me. I encountered a work table with my hip, cursed the bruise, and then groped my way to the hearth. I found the tinderbox on the end of the mantel. When I finally had a tiny flame going in the neglected hearth, I quickly lit the half-burnt candles from the mantel candelabrum to give me some light. I fed up the fire, more for light than warmth. The room was dismal, dusty, and dank after weeks with no fire in the hearth. The flames would freshen the air. I was aware of Gilly an instant before he burst into the room from one of his own hiding places, full of enthusiasm at the thought that the sausage-bringers had finally returned. When he discovered that I had only the smell and a lick or two of grease on my fingers, he gave me a nip of rebuke and tried to climb up my leg. "Not now, friend. I'll bring you treats later. First, I must see the Queen." I hastily smoothed my hair back into a short warrior's tail. I wished there was time to do better, but I knew Cotricken would tolerate my unkempt appearance more than she would my dawdling to change it. I entered the secret corridors and made my way to the door that gave on to the Queen's privy room, and thence to her private sitting room. I paused to listen carefully at the door before I opened it, not wishing to walk in on her if she had any company. I nearly fell when Cotricken jerked the door open.
"I heard your footstep. I've been waiting for you. Oh, it seems like the entire day. I am so glad you are home, Fitz. So glad to see someone to whom I may speak freely."
Cotricken was not the calm and rational queen I knew. She looked haggard and anxious. The usually serene room was almost disorderly. The wicks of the white candles that burned on her low table needed trimming, and a forgotten wine glass, still a quarter full, idled on the table. There was a pot of tea on the table, and cups for us, with a crumble of tea herb spilled beside it. Two scrolls relating to the out-islands and their customs were on the corner of the table. Later, I would discover that it was not just the sporadic and cryptic reports that Chade and Dutiful had sent her through Nettle that had frayed her, but a civil uprising between old blood and piebalds that had erupted in the six duchies in our absence. For the last 3 weeks, she had dealt with murders and retaliations, followed by more slaughter. Although there had been no killings reported in the last 6 days, she still dreaded a knock at her chamber door and a messenger's baton presented to her. It was ironic that she had forced a measure of tolerance for the witted on her nobles, only to have the witted turn on one another. But that was not discussed that morning. She begged a full report of me so that she might have a better foundation for the decisions Dutiful and Chade were demanding from her. I obediently began it, only to have her interrupt with questions of how my first encounter with the Hetgird related to what was happening now, and whether I thought Eliania's people would resent our taking of her to be our queen, and whether Eliania herself came willingly to Dutiful's side. After the fifth such interruption she caught herself. "I am sorry." She had seated herself on a low bench beside the table. I could see her frustration that I had not been a witness to the party's return to Aslevial and Eliania's mother's house. I could not give her my view of the Outlander reactions to the dragon, for I had not seen them. She started to ask another question. I held up a hand. "Why not let me contact Prince Dutiful or Lord Shade? That is why I came home. Let us have them answer your immediate questions, and then, if need be, I will report in full all that I saw and did." She smiled.
"You take this magic for granted now. It still surprises me. Nettle has done her best for us, and she is a fine young woman. But Chade is so secretive, and Dutiful's messages seemed awkward. If you would reach for my son, please."
There followed for me the most wearying morning of skilling that I'd ever endured. I had built stamina for the magic, but for the first time in my life I came to understand just how earlier coteries had served their rulers. Knowing it was closest to her heart, I reached first for Dutiful, who was delighted to find me safely home. There followed from him an outpouring to his mother that I could scarcely keep up with. At first it was awkward, for he spoke to her as son to mother, with a familiarity that was proper to such a relationship, but difficult for me. As he conveyed his thoughts on the events, it was also taxing for me to refrain from correcting him, for it was inevitable that his views did not perfectly coincide with mine. He revealed that he had offered to release Eliania from their mutual bond. It was after they had come close to quarrelling. She saw no reason why they could not be married and yet allow her to remain as Narcheska of the Narwhals, with Dutiful coming and going as the other husbands and lovers did. It had, he confided to his mother through me, deeply hurt her when he said he could not give up his throne to be her husband.
"She asked me why not. Was not that what I was asking of her, that she forsake home, family, and title, to become my wife in a strange place? And, moreover, to rob her clan of the children that should be rightfully theirs? It was difficult, mother. She made me see it all in a different light. Even now, when I think of it, I wonder if what we do is right." "But she would be queen here. Do not they recognize what honor and power would go with such a title?"
And when I had passed Katrikan's words to her son, I felt his regret as he said, "She will not be Narwhal clan any more." When at first her mother would not release her, she became angry. She threatened to leave her clan without her mother's permission. It was a very ugly moment. Piotr stood by her, but almost all the women of the clan opposed Eliania. Her mother said that if she left, she would be forsaking them, to become a... well, they have a word for it. It is not an honorable one to call a woman. It is one who has stolen from her own people to give to strangers. Many of their rules, including their ones for hospitality, insist that family must be provided for first. This, then, is a grave insult. I relayed Katrikan's concern. "But it has been resolved now. She leaves her people with her honor intact."
"I think it has. Her mother and the Great Mother have consented. Still, you know how a thing may be said in words but not meant in the heart. It is like how some of our nobles tolerate the old blood, to the letter of the law, but with no heart to be fair to them."
"I know well what you mean. It has been difficult here, Dutiful, while you were gone. I have done my best, but I look forward to Webb's return. The bloodshed has been appalling, and many of my lesser nobles are muttering that it is as they said, that the witted are little better than the animals they mate with, and that freed of the curb of punishment, they are happy to slaughter one another. The old blood's zeal to eliminate the piebalds has blackened the reputation of the witted rather than cleared it."
And so their talk wandered from one thing to another. After a time it was almost as if they forgot I was there. I grew hoarse repeating to Katrikan all that Dutiful wished to say to her. I sensed his relief that neither Chade nor Nettle were a party to the conversation. He confided many doubts, and yet also the small, sweet triumphs of his courtship of his bride. There was a particular shade of green that she liked, and he took great pains in describing it, for he hoped that the personal chambers that welcomed her to Buckkeep could incorporate it. He had many minor complaints over how Chade had handled the most recent round of negotiations, and many areas in which he wanted the Queen to rein in her chief counsellor. Here Catricken and Dutiful did not precisely agree, and I was again hard put to serve only as go-between without injecting any of my own thoughts. And gradually, as they employed my magic for the best interests of the Farseer throne, I began to be aware of the skill current. It pulled me in a new way, not the impulsive dive-into-it-and-be-lost-forever temptation I knew only too well, but like music heard in another chamber. Lovely music that draws the attention away from what one is supposed to be doing until one becomes immersed in only it. At first it was distant, like the thunder of rapids heard while one drifts in the calm part of the river. It drew me, but not strongly. I thought I was ignoring it. The prince's words to the queen, and her replies, flowed through me, and I scarce had to pay attention to what I said or the thoughts I sent to Dutiful. It began to seem that the skill itself was flowing through me, as if I were the river, and I was only jolted from it when the queen leaned forward and shook me hard. "Fitz!" she cried out, and "Fitz!" I dutifully relayed to Dutiful. Then, "Wake him, however you must. Throw water in his face. Pinch him. I fear if I retreat now, he will go under all the way." And even as I spoke Dutiful's words to the queen, she took up her cup of cooling tea and dashed it in my face. I spluttered, coughed, and was once more fully aware of my surroundings. "I'm sorry," I said, wiping my sleeve over my face. "That has never happened to me before. At least, not in this fashion." The queen offered me a kerchief. "We've had some minor difficulties of this type with Nettle. It was one reason Chade wanted you to be here as soon as possible." He said something of the kind. I wish he had been more specific. I would have found a way to come sooner. "She will need instruction in the skill, Fitz. It should begin soon. Actually, it should have begun long ago." "I know that now," I admitted humbly. "A lot of things should have begun long ago. I'm home now, and I intend to begin them soon." "How about now?" Catricken asked me levelly. "I could summon my maid and send for Nettle. You could meet her now." A wave of dread washed through me. "Not yet." And then I amended it to, "Not like this, my lady. Please let me be clean and shaven and rested." I took a breath. "And fed," I added, trying not to make it sound like a remonstrance.
"Oh, Fitz, I am sorry. I have let my own needs and desires run rampant over yours, a selfish act. I apologize."
"A necessary act," I assured her. "Then, shall I find Dutiful again? Or Chade? I know there is still much you need to know."
"Not just now. I judge it best that you refrain from skilling for a time."
I nodded. Left alone in my own mind, I felt almost empty, as if I could no longer string together a thought of my own. It must have showed, for she leaned forward to set her hand on mine.
"Some brandy, Lord Fitzchivalry?"
"Please," I replied, and my queen rose to get it for us. Some time later I twitched my eyes open. A shawl had been put around me, and my chin rested on my chest. My brandy waited on the table before me. Catricken was sitting quietly at the table, looking at her folded hands. I knew she meditated and did not wish to disturb her, yet she seemed aware that I had awakened almost as soon as I opened my eyes. She gave me a weary smile.
"My queen, I offer my humblest apologies. You have been long without rest."
She muffled a small yawn of her own and said,
"I sent for breakfast and let my maid know I am famished. She will wish to tidy this room before she sets it out for me here. Conceal yourself until you hear me knock."
And so I spent some short time sitting on the steps in the darkness behind the concealed panel. I closed my eyes, but did not sleep. Yet it was not the burdens of the Six Duchies' throne that waited on my thoughts. I was but a tool to be used in that sorting. I would eat with the queen, visit the steams and shave, sleep for a short time, and then find a way to slip out of the castle and go back to the witness stones. I would raid the storeroom first, I decided, and take with me cheese and fruit and wine for the fool and the black man. Perhaps they would enjoy some fresh bread. I smiled to myself, thinking how they would welcome the change in food.
Perhaps the fool would be better and able to travel. If he was, I could bring them both to Buckkeep, where I would know the fool was safe. And finally, I would be free to go to Molly and heal the rift of years. I heard the Queen's tap on the wall. She had taken advantage of the time to smooth her hair and don a fresh gown. A meal, ample for several people, was set out on the low table. Tea steamed from a flowered pot, and I smelled fresh bread and butter melting on hot porridge beside a pot of thick yellow cream.
"Come and eat,"
she welcomed me, "and if you have a word left in you, tell me of what you have been through, and how it is that you and Thick have discovered such a swift way to travel." I realized then the depth of the Queen's faith in me. So much had not been relayed through Nettle for the sake of keeping Chade's secrets. Only by subtle hints had she known to expect me, and yet she had believed we would arrive. And so, as we ate, I found myself reporting to her yet again. She had always been a good listener, and over the years had been my confidant more than once. Perhaps that was why I found myself telling her far more of the truth than I had confided to anyone else. I told her of my search through the city for the fool's body, and tears ran down her cheeks unchecked when I told her where and how I had found him. Her pale eyes brimmed with wonder as I told her how we had returned to the abandoned plaza. To her alone did I confide my venture into death. To her alone did I give a full accounting of our visit to the dragons themselves in the restoration of the Rooster Crown. Only once did she interrupt. I had told her of brushing the dust and leaves off Verity Asdragon. She instantly reached across the table to seize my hand in a cool, hard grip.
"With these pillars, if you held my hand, could you take me to him? Even just once?
I know, all that would not be there for me. Yet even to touch the stone that holds him. Oh, Fitz, you have no idea what that would mean to me."
To take an unskilled person through a pillar. I do not know the full toll it might take on your mind. It could be arduous and dangerous, my queen. I was reluctant, and yet even more reluctant, to disappoint her.
"And Dutiful?"
she said, as if she had not heard my warning at all.
"Dutiful should stand at least once by the dragon of his father. It would make real his father's sacrifice to him, and he might perceive his own in a kindlier light then."
"Dutiful sacrifice."
"Did you not hear what he could not say?"
"That as a man, he could have stayed there with Eliania and been her husband and welcomed by her family. As a prince, he cannot."
"It is not a small sacrifice, Fitz Chivalry. Eliania will follow him here, that is true, but ever it will be a little wall between them. You yourself have known how sharp that can be, to disappoint the woman you love, out of the duty you must yield to your people."
I spoke without considering the wisdom of it. "I will be going back for her now. The time for that sacrifice is at an end. Barrick is gone and no longer stands between us. I will take Molly again for my own." A silence followed my words, and I realized I had shocked her. Then she said gently,
"I am glad that at last you have found that resolve. I speak now as a woman and your friend. Do not go to Molly too soon. Let her son come home to her first. Let her family heal around the terrible wound. Then approach her, but as yourself, not as a man coming to take Burick's place."
I knew her words were wise as soon as I heard them, but my heart howled to rush to Molly as soon as I could, to begin as soon as possible to make up the years we had lost. I wanted to comfort her in her grief. I bowed my head, realizing the selfishness of that impulse. Hard as it would be for me to stand to one side and wait, it was what I should do, for the sake of Burick's sons.
"And the same for Nettle," Katrickan went on implacably. "She will soon know that something has changed when I do not call on her to pass messages to Dutiful for me, yet if you will listen to me, do not rush to her. Above all, do not try to replace her father, for such Burick was to her. Fitz, through no fault of your own, such she will always be. You will have to find another role in her life, and be content with it."
They were bitter words for me to hear, and more bitter still was it for me to admit, I know. I sighed. "I will teach her the skill. That time I will have with her." I resumed my tale for the Queen, and by the time I reached the end of it the pot of tea was gone. I was a bit abashed to see that I had cleared the table of food. I suspected that Katrickan had eaten little of it.
I blinked my sandy eyes and tried to stifle a huge yawn. She smiled at me wearily.
Go and sleep, Fitz.
Thank you.
I shall.
Then, well aware I was not supposed to know her identity, I asked the Queen, If you would speak to Chade's new apprentice, it would be of great help to me. The third storeroom in the East Hall is where he used to have supplies left for Thick to bring up to his tower room. As soon as a fool can travel, I plan to bring him back to Buckkeep. The tower room might be the best place for him to stay, until he can shed his identity as Lord Golden. Chade's apprentice could stock the room if she... And there I bit my tongue, knowing I'd betrayed myself in my weariness. Queen Katrickan gave me a tolerant smile.
I'll tell Lady Rosemary to make the arrangements. And if I need you?
I pondered briefly, then realized the obvious. Ask Nettle to contact Thick. She shook her head.
I plan to send Nettle home to her family for a time. They need her. It is not fair that they be apart at this time.
I nodded. Thick will be about. You could keep him at your side. It might be a good way to occupy him and keep him from telling too many tales of how he came home. She nodded gravely. I bowed, suddenly horribly weary.
Go, Fitz, and take my thanks with you.
Oh! The sharpness of her intake of breath warned me.
What? Lady Patience is expected. She sent me word of her visit at the same time that she told me she wished to convey Withywoods on Lady Nettle. She also warned me that she wished to consult me on serious matters concerning certain inheritances that should be provided for now.
There was little point in mincing words. I am sure she knows that Nettle is my daughter. Ada help the poor child if Patience has decided to take over her education. I smiled ruefully at my remembrance of Patience's instruction of me. Queen Katrickan nodded to that. Solemnly she asked,
What is the saying, all your chickens have come home to roost?
I think that's it. But strangely enough, my Lady Queen, I welcome them.
I am glad to hear you say so.
She nodded to me that I was excused. I left the room and the climb back up to Chade's tower seemed endless. When I got there, I lay down on the bed. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep. But it suddenly seemed the skill current was very near. Perhaps it was because of my long exercise with it that morning. I opened my eyes and became aware I could smell myself. I heaved a sigh and decided that getting cleaned up before I slept would not be a bad idea. Once more, I wound my way through the immense old castle, avoiding the guard room and the inevitable barrage of questions. I found the steams relatively deserted at that time of day. The two guardsmen there did not know me, and while they greeted me affably enough, they asked no questions. I was as much relieved at that as I was to scrape the whiskers from my face. I gave myself a most thorough scrubbing, and then, feeling as if I had been parboiled, emerged clean and ready to sleep. Nettle was waiting for me outside the steams.
Chapter 33 Family. So I shall have to travel to Buckkeep in the heat of summer, because I dare not trust either the tidings I bring or the items that must be transferred to a courier. My old Lacey has declared she will make the journey with me, despite a weakness of her breath that has taken her lately. I beg that, for her sake, you will find us quarters that do not require the climbing of too many stairs. I will require a private audience with you, for the time has come when I should reveal a secret I have concealed for many years. As you are not a stupid woman, I suspect you have guessed part of it already, but I should still like to sit down and discuss with you what had best be done for the good of the young woman involved. Missive from Lady Patience to Queen Katrickan. I knew her at once by her close-cropped head, but there her resemblance to my dream image of her stopped. The travelling dress she wore was green, cut for riding, and she carried a cloak of sensible brown homespun. Plainly she saw herself as looking like her mother, for thus she had appeared in my dreams. To my eyes she more strongly resembled Molly's father, but with some farseer elements thrown into the mix. It was a farseer gaze that she fixed on me as I emerged, at once dashing my hope that I might walk past her unrecognized. I halted where I stood. I froze and waited dumbly for what might come. She continued to regard me levelly. After a moment she said quietly,
"Do you think that if you stand very still,
I can't see you, Shadow Wolf. I smiled foolishly. Her voice was low-pitched, deeper than one might expect in a girl, like Molly's at that age. I... No. Of course not. I know you can see me. But how did you know me? She came 2 steps closer. I looked around us, and then I walked away from the steams, well aware that for a young noblewoman of the Buckkeep Court to be seen casually chatting with an older guardsman might excite gossip. She walked beside me, following me unquestioningly as I led her toward a secluded bench in the woman's garden. "Oh, it was very easy. You had promised you'd reveal yourself to me, did you not? I knew you were coming home. Dutiful said as much when we spoke last night, that soon I would be freed of these duties for a time. So when the Queen summoned me and told me I might return home to comfort my mother for a time, I knew what it meant. That you were here. Then... And she smiled, a genuine smile of pleasure. I encountered Thick on his way up to the Queen as I was leaving her. I knew him by his music, as well as by his name. And he knew me at first glance. Such a hug he gave me. It shocked Lady Siddle, but she will recover. I asked Thick where his travelling companion was. He shut his eyes for a moment and told me, in the steams. So I came, and I waited there.
I wished that Thick had warned me. And you knew me when you saw me. She gave a small humph.
I recognize the dismay on your face at being found out. None of the other men who have come out gawked at me that way.
She gave me a sideways glance, well pleased with herself, but there were little sparks in her eyes. I wondered if mine looked like that when I was angry. She spoke calmly and competently, just as Molly sometimes used to do when she was storing up fuel for a rage. After a moment's reflection, I decided she had the right to be annoyed with me. I had promised to make myself known to her when I returned, and I had intended to evade that promise.
"Well, you found me," I said lamely, and instantly knew it was exactly the wrong thing to say to her. "Small thanks to you!" She seated herself solidly on the bench. I stood, well aware of the disparity in our apparent ranks. She had to look up at me, but it did not seem that way when she demanded, "What is your name, sir?" So I had to give her the name by which I was known when I wore the blue of a Buckkeep guard. "Tom Badgerlock, my lady, of the Prince's Guard." She suddenly looked like a cat with a mouse between her paws.
"That's convenient for me. The Queen said she would have a guardsman accompany me on my journey home. I'll take you."
It was a challenge flung down. "I am not free to go, my lady." It sounded like an excuse, and I hastily added, "I take over your duties, as you have guessed. I act as go-between for Lord Chade, Prince Dutiful, and our gracious Queen."
"Surely Thick could do that."
"His magic is strong, but he has his limits, my lady."
"My lady," she muttered disdainfully.
"And what shall I call you, then? Lord Wolf?" She shook her head, exasperated with me. "I know you were telling me the truth. Worse luck for me." Her shoulders slumped suddenly, and her youth and grief were more apparent. "It is not an easy tale I bring home to my mother and brothers.
But they deserve to know the manner of our father's death,
and that Swift did not abandon him."
Without thinking, she lifted her hands and ran them through her shortened hair, until it stood up in spires and peaks all over her head.
"This magic of the skill has not been an easy burden for me. It has snatched me from my home and kept me here when my mother needs me most."
Turning to me, accusingly, she demanded,
"Why did you choose me, of all people, to give this magic to?"
It shocked me. "I didn't. I didn't choose you. You had it. You were born with the magic, and for some reason we connected. I didn't even realize you were there, watching my life for a very long time."
"There were times when that was obvious," she observed.
But before I wondered what I had unwittingly shown her of myself, she added,
"And now I have it, like some disease, and it means that I am ever in service to my queen, and to King Dutiful, when he succeeds her. I don't suppose you can even imagine what a burden like that could be to me."
"I have some inkling of it," I replied quietly.
Then, when she continued to sit unmoving before me, I asked her, "Should not you be on your way? Daylight is the best time for travel."
"We have just met, and you were so anxious for us to be parted."
She looked down at the ground beneath her feet. Suddenly she was Nettle from our dreams, as she shook her head and said,
"This is not at all how I imagined our first meeting would be. I thought you would be happy to see me, and we would laugh and be friends."
She gave a small cough, and then admitted shyly,
"A long time ago, when I first had dreams about you and the wolf, I used to imagine that we would really meet some day. I pretended you would be my age, and handsome, and find me pretty. That was silly, wasn't it?"
"I'm sorry to have disappointed you," I said carefully. "I definitely find you pretty, however." She gave me a look that said that such compliments from an aging guardsman made her uncomfortable. Her illusions about me had made a barrier I had not expected. I came closer to her and then crouched down beside her to look up into her eyes. "Could we, perhaps, begin this again?" I put out a hand to her and said, "My name is Shadow Wolf, and Nettle, you cannot imagine how many years I have longed to meet you." Without warning, my throat closed tight. I hoped I would not get teary. My daughter hesitated, and then set her hand in mine. It was slender, like a lady's hand should be, but brown from the sun, and her palm against mine was calloused. The touch strengthened our skill bond, and it was as if she squeezed my heart rather than my fingers. Even if I had wanted to hide what I felt from her, I could not have done so. I think it breached some wall she had held. She looked up into my face, on a level with hers now. Our eyes met, and suddenly her lower lip trembled like a baby's.
"My papa is dead,"
she stammered out.
"My papa is dead, and I don't know what to do. How can we go on? Chivalry is such a boy still, and Mama knows nothing of the horses. Already she speaks of selling them off and moving to a town, saying she cannot abide to be where my father so emphatically is not."
She choked, and then gasped.
"It's all going to fall apart. I'm going to fall apart. I can't be as strong as everyone expects me to be. But I have to."
She drew herself up, straight, and faced me.
"I have to be strong,"
she repeated, as if that would turn her bones to iron. It seemed to work. No tears. Hers was a desperate courage. I caught her in my arms and held her tight, for the first time in her life or mine. I held my daughter. Her cropped hair was bristly against my chin, and all I could think was how much I loved her. I opened myself to her and let it flood from me into her. I felt her shock, both at the depth of my feeling and that a relative stranger would touch her so. I tried to explain. "I will look after you," I told her. "I'll look after all of you, I promised. I promised your papa I would do that. Look after you and your little brothers. And I will."
"I don't think you can," she said. "Not as he did."
But, trying to gentle her words, she added,
"I do believe you will try. But there is no one like my papa in the world. No one."
For a moment longer she let me hold her. Then, gently, she disentangled herself from me. Subdued, she said,
"My horse will be saddled and waiting, and the guardsman the queen assigned me will be there also."
She took a huge breath, held it, then slowly let it out.
"I have to go. There will be a lot to do at home. Mama cannot manage the babies as well as she used to with Papa gone. I'm needed there."
She found her kerchief and dabbed unshed tears from her eyes. "Yes, I'm sure you are." I hesitated and then said, "There was a message from your father. You may think it odd or frivolous, but it was important to him." She looked at me quizzically. "When Malta comes into season, Ruddy is to stud her."